On today's Media Roundtable, we're discussing coverage of women, sexism, sexual assault, and abortion rights. The video of Donald Trump boasting about sexual assault and the allegations that continue to come in from women who are accusing him of groping and forcibly kissing them is receiving 24/7 coverage. So how has this election changed the public discourse about women's lives? Republicans say Trump's comments about women's genitals are highly offensive, and yet many of their policies regulate and control women's genitals. So who is connecting those dots? Join us after the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. In one of his strongest interventions during the US election campaign, President Obama has warned Americans that democracy itself is on the ballot when they cast their votes in November. Speaking at a campaign rally for Hillary Clinton in Ohio, Mr. Obama condemned a threat by the Republican candidate Donald Trump to jail Mrs. Clinton if he was elected. He also said Mr. Trump did not have the temperament, knowledge, and honest character needed by a president.
This is a guy who spent all his time hanging around trying to convince everybody he was a global elite. Talking about how great his buildings are, and how luxurious and how rich he is, and flying around everywhere. And all he had time for was celebrities. And now suddenly he's acting like he's a populist out there. Man, I'm going to fight for working people. Come on, man. You want to know what somebody's going to do? Look what they've been doing their whole lives.
A 96-year-old former prime minister will take over royal duties in Thailand following the death of King Bhumibol Adulyadet. The crown prince had been expected to take the throne immediately, but the country's military government said on Thursday that he wanted to spend time mourning the death of his father before being anointed. 24 hours later, it announced that Prem Tinasulanon, the trusted ally of the former king, would act as regent. The surprise move has increased speculation that the succession may not proceed as smoothly as first thought. Suspected Islamist militants in Egypt have killed 12 members of the security forces in an attack in the Sinai Peninsula. A military statement said the gunmen targeted a checkpoint 80 kilometres east of the Suez Canal. According to the army, 15 of the attackers were killed. The Sinai is a scene of an insurgency that's being waged by militants loyal to the Islamic State group. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari has responded to public criticism from his wife by saying she belongs in his home. Mr. Buhari, who's on an official visit to Germany, was talking in front of perhaps the world's most powerful woman, Angela Merkel. He said with a smile, "I don't know which party my wife belongs to, but she belongs in my kitchen and my living room and the other room." Ms. Merkel is reported to have glared at him and then laughed. In a BBC interview earlier, Aisha Buhari had warned that she would not support her husband if he stands at the next election unless he makes changes to his government. The brother of a Syrian migrant suspected of planning a bomb attack on a Berlin airport says he was radicalized by an Islamist preacher in the German capital. The brother told Der Spiegel magazine that the imam had brainwashed Jabir al-Bakr while he was living in Germany after fleeing Syria in 2014. He said he'd been encouraged by the imam to return to Syria, where he was trained by Islamic State jihadists. World News from the BBC. Turkey says it's determined to be included in the imminent American-led coalition offensive against Islamic State militants in the Iraqi city of Mosul. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, said that if his country was excluded from the operation, he would resort to what he called a Plan B. The United States says it's ending limits on the amount of rum and cigars that American tourists can bring back from their trips to Cuba. It's part of a wider relaxation by Washington of restrictions on trade between the U.S. and Cuba. Will Grant is in Havana.
The president cannot lift the embargo without Congress, but he can weaken it significantly. He has done that on several occasions over the past 2 years, and this latest decision also relaxed the stringent rules on trade and travel. The most important announcement is probably the move to lift a restriction on cargo ship travel between the old enemies that had prevented them from docking in US ports for at least 180 days after visiting Cuba. But undoubtedly the most eye-catching was the decision to lift the $100 limit on rum and cigars, which American travelers are allowed to bring back from their trips to the island.
Mexico's national security chief says the country is aiming to extradite the drugs lord Joaquin Guzman to the United States early next year. Renato Salas Heredia said he hoped to remove Guzman, who's known by his nickname El Chapo, in January or February. Guzman's lawyer said his client had instructed him to fight extradition to the end. A collection of cave drawings found in the Spanish town of Lecatio has been described as the most spectacular and impressive ever discovered on the Iberian Peninsula. The pictures, about 50 of them, date back up to 14,000 years. They depict horses, bison, goats and, unusually, two lions. Although the cave was well known to locals, nobody had ventured far enough inside to find the 15-metre-long panel of drawings. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Well, earlier this year, the national media gave Donald Trump an unprecedented amount of uncritical media coverage. Today, he is threatening to sue the New York Times for publishing allegations from at least six women who are publicly accusing him of groping and forcibly kissing them over the decades. These allegations and the video of Trump boasting about sexual assault are receiving 24/7 media coverage. So what do you make of the coverage? Where's the coverage of the Republican Party's ongoing assault on reproductive rights? So many Republicans are now backing away from Donald Trump, saying that his comments about women's genitals are highly offensive. And yet, many of their policies regulate and control women's genitals. So who is connecting those dots? In fact, in a speech at Liberty University on Wednesday, Donald Trump's running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, said a Trump-Pence ticket will defund Planned Parenthood. He also said he longs to see the day that Roe v. Wade is, quote, consigned to the ash heap of history where it belongs, end quote. Earlier this year, Mike Pence signed an anti-abortion bill that was too extreme for his own party, and a federal judge blocked the law in June. Joining us to discuss these issues and media coverage are three guests. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, a nonprofit daily online publication covering reproductive and sexual health, rights, and justice. Hi, Jody. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you for having me again.
Great to have you back. We're also joined by Sarah Kenzior, an op-ed columnist for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail, where she focuses on U.S. politics, race, and economic inequality. Hi, Sarah. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And Esther Lee is a reporter with Think Progress, where she covers immigration and refugees. Think Progress is a progressive news outlet. Hi, Esther. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you, as we always do on Your Calls Media Roundtable. We start off on a positive note, and we need some positive news right now. And we would like to point out journalism that really stood out and reporters who did a good job. So, Jody, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I have had precious little time for lots of reading this week, unfortunately, but I really am liking this Matt Taibbi piece in Rolling Stone, The Fury and Failure of Donald Trump. Unfortunately, I've been sort of consumed with Donald Trump this week, but I really do think he's given a very humorous and also very exacting analysis of what's been going on in terms of the broader political landscape, and you know, the fact that, as I also contend, that Donald Trump is the Frankenstein monster created by the far right, and they deserve him because everything they have done to date over the past two decades has led to this point.
And is that Matt Taibbi's overall argument in that piece?
In this piece, yeah, he does talk about it. He's looking more at the sort of more recent, you know, ways in which people like Ryan and others are trying to pretend Trump doesn't even exist while still giving to the crowds that have now become sort of like the Coliseum crowds, those who are there looking for Trump and getting Ryan instead and very upset about it, looking at how there's this sort of, you know, desperate attempt by the Republicans to pretend Trump doesn't even exist while giving people the same tired bromides they've been giving people before, and it's not working.
USA Today just a couple of days ago has a piece about a quarter of elected top Republicans who will not endorse Trump. The lead says 26% of Republican governors and members of Congress are refusing to endorse Trump. This is according to a survey by USA Today. They found that some of them were not going to endorse him months ago. Some turned on him because of the video, and some basically will not say publicly whether or not they will vote for him.
Yes. Well, I have seen another count where since the video, 29 Republicans, including both senators and congresspeople, and also leading voices, if you will, in the Republican Party like Hugh Hewitt, unendorsed him since the tape. So I think there are different ways of cutting that list, but that was a list that I saw about 3 days ago. I think that was in, I can't remember which publication ran it.
Okay. Well, so kudos to Matt Taibbi with the Rolling Stone for his analysis about what is happening right now. And what about you, Sarah? What caught your attention this week?
Well, I think the most important piece I read this week was not by a journalist, but by Yusuf Salam, who was one of the Central Park Five falsely accused of sexual assault in the late 80s. And he talked about Donald Trump's long persecutory campaign against him and others. He was cleared of charges, but Trump, you know, maintains that he is guilty, much in the same way, you know, Trump lies and you know, goes after other people and, you know, falsely smears them with defamatory attacks. And so I thought, you know, it's a very powerful piece. It also says a lot about race, a lot about police brutality, but it shows a consistent pattern with Trump that, you know, the media has been very reluctant to admit to until recently. You know, all these revelations about Trump's character and the way he treats people are not new. He's been this way, you know, his entire life, and this case goes back 27 years. And so I thought it was important that that piece was published and that firsthand perspective of what it's like to be targeted by him was out there.
And where was that published?
In the Washington Post.
Washington Post. I'm so glad you brought this up because Yusuf Salam was on Democracy Now! This morning talking about this. And just to give a little bit of background, in 89, five African-American and Latino teens were arrested for beating and raping a white woman in Central Park in New York. They were known as the Central Park Five. And Donald Trump took out full-page ads in newspapers in New York calling for their execution. I thought Juan Gonzalez's lead was so chilling. If Donald Trump had his way, our next guest would have been executed over two decades ago. And Yusuf Salam was on Democracy Now! Talking about this case. And I want to watch the Central Park Five documentary over the weekend. I think you can get it on Netflix. So thank you. Check out that piece written by Yusuf Salam in the Washington Post and then see him or hear him on Democracy Now! Today. Thanks for that, Sarah. And what about you, Esther? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Sure. So the piece I would definitely recommend everybody to go read is a piece by my colleague Samantha Page at Think Progress. She wrote a piece about kids and elderly people who live in nine states who spend a scary amount of time near fracking sites. So this is the piece is about 650,000 children live within 1 mile of a fracking facility. And as we may already know, fracking has been linked to health and environmental risks and asthma and migraines. So this is a real problem that affects hundreds of thousands of people, and it's something that we're not focusing on, unfortunately, because we have to focus on what Donald Trump has said.
And what were the studies in this piece about health risks and what these children are facing on a regular basis and these older people?
Right. So this was based on a study that looked at where in these nine states that these kids and elderly people lived, and it was found that, you know, schools and their homes are near these fracking sites.
Yeah, so important. So kudos to Samantha Page at Think Progress for her piece about children and older people in nine states who are living very close to fracking sites. That sounds like a good show. Thank you for that, Esther. Well, let's dive in here and talk about what we have been facing over the last week. On so many levels, this has been such a surreal and dark presidential election race. And you know, earlier this year, Donald Trump, with the help of the media, really shaped the narrative. He got so much free, mostly uncritical coverage. Now he is threatening to sue the New York Times for publishing those allegations from at least six women who are accusing him of groping and forcibly kissing them over the decades. And then that tape came out earlier from the Washington Post last weekend in which he boasts about sexually assaulting a woman. This is now the sort of defining moment for the party, and the media are now really exposing Donald Trump. Jody, you have been covering Donald Trump very closely over the past year. What are your thoughts about where we are right now and how the media are really focusing on this video and these accusations and how this has become kind of the defining moment of the election?
Well, for one thing, just wanted to note that just right before I got on the phone, and you may well be aware of this, but right before I got on the phone, two more women have come forward, one in the Post, Washington Post, and the other who's apparently appearing in a press conference with Gloria Allred. So there are more accusations coming out, and I suspect we'll see many more of those. I mean, look, I think that, as I said earlier, Donald Trump is the making of, has been made by two forces. One is the Republican Party's long history of denigrating people, whether they be people of color, women, immigrants, denigrating people in order to conserve the white vote and the white male vote particularly, and at the same time not really delivering to people what they claimed they were going to deliver. And the second is the media. The media really helped create Donald Trump because from the very time he started campaigning, media were all over him and giving him lots and lots of press in the same way they did the Tea Party, which I personally think amplified and legitimized both the Tea Party and Donald Trump. And so now we're at a place where we have a man who is, I think, personally unhinged, has absolutely zero understanding of or interest in policy, not irrespective of ideology. I just don't think he has any understanding or desire to understand policy, and he's grotesque. He's absolutely grotesque. I feel personally, and I said this today for the very first time, I feel personally triggered by this guy, and I'm not one to get triggered very easily. The constant slew of attacks on women is just, it's so bald-faced, and yet, it is in keeping with the fact that the GOP has been attacking women and attacking women's reproduction and reproductive and sexual lives for years now. So, in a way, again, they've created that monster as well. Mm. And now they have to look aside as he attacks women from the perspective of actually suggesting he rapes and assaults them. Mm. It's just really, it's profound. I don't even know what to make of it anymore.
Well, I think that's why it's a struggle to even come up with concise questions about what we're dealing with right now. I mean, I was covering Standing Rock last weekend and then found out about the video. And so I guess one of the main questions is how do you explain the media really shifting and now really being critical of Donald Trump as a result of this video? I mean, it sort of, you know, they were coming out. People like David K. Johnston have been doing excellent reporting. And the Washington Post has been doing some longer pieces about how hotel workers have been exploited. But it seems like now the media are full force really looking at Donald Trump. And, of course, this video and these allegations are just dominating the news cycle. What about that shift that happened so quickly?
Is that to me?
Yes.
I mean, look, you know, I think the media generally, and of course I'm being broad brush here because, you know, we're media, you're media, and I don't think we come at it the same way as what I'm talking about, but generally speaking, in elections, we talk about the horse race. Who's got this much polling? Who won this debate by style? Oh, Mike Pence, you know, won because he avoided these questions. We don't talk about substance. I mean, apparently in the next debate, there isn't even going to be a single question about climate change. Mm-hmm. And we haven't had a single question in debates. If there's a threat that we're facing that we're not talking about, it's climate change. And yet the media avoids these things. So we have, you know, it's a disservice to democracy and the public that we do not do more in-depth reporting on issues. And then once the sort of controversy gets lit, whichever controversy is the most sexy is the one that gets the media's attention. And here we have Donald Trump, you know, really out there boldly talking about being abusive toward women. And while I think it's the media's duty, absolutely, to bring this out and make it clear, these things should have been brought up before. I mean, there are investigative reporters for this kind of stuff. People do opposition research all the time. Lots of people actually knew these things. So the media does not do its job in the election cycle because they're constantly playing, you know, which side's got a touchdown rather than what is actually happening and what are the actual policies being proposed. Hmm. And that's how someone like this gets this far.
Sarah, what would you add to that?
I think that's a very good analysis, especially that there is this, you know, twofold blame to go around with both the GOP and the media. One thing I'm a little bit skeptical of is that it's a desire for a horse race that's fueled this kind of coverage, because as we saw with scandals that occurred with Trump earlier in the campaign, negative coverage brings just as much, you know, ratings and clicks as, you know, any kind of horse race or positive coverage. There's not really, you know, a sound financial incentive to say something positive about Trump, to write puff pieces about Trump. There's no real reason for that. And, you know, I kind of wonder, given that Trump has been such a seminal part of the media and business landscape, he has ties with Jeff Zucker, who apparently has a framed picture of a Trump tweet in his office. He's linked to NBC through, you know, The Apprentice, you know, and there's people that have dirt on Trump, but Trump, you know, by extension, has dirt on people. He would have had dirt, for example, on Billy Bush. And so I think, you know, we're possibly seeing a media that's been restraining themselves because of those ties. And Trump has openly threatened, you know, reporters. He's threatened to reveal their secrets and to humiliate them. A good example of that, I think, is Joe Scarborough, you know, where Trump has threatened them multiple times. And then yesterday you have him on MSNBC, you know, defending Trump, implying that these women are liars and implying that the Clinton campaign orchestrated this. And next to him sits Mika Brzezinski, basically looking like she's going to burst into tears. And so, you know, well, I do think there's a more critical turn to the Trump campaign, and I absolutely agree that it's come much too late. You're still seeing a lot of positive coverage and a lot of very strange things, like Corey Lewandowski still being on CNN while being paid. You know, I can't
absolutely
think of an example, you know, like that. So there's something, I think, a little more sinister at work.
Well, you brought up a lot of stuff there. Jeff Zucker is the current president of CNN, former president of NBC, and then Joe Scarborough. We've talked about this a few times on the show. I mean, earlier, before the primaries, Donald Trump had a phone call with Joe every day, and it was just softball, nothing interesting at all about that phone call. And then all of a sudden, he did a 180 and started kind of lashing out at Donald Trump. Esther, what are your thoughts? I mean, it's so interesting that Republicans have come forward and said, okay, this is it. This video is unacceptable. You cannot talk about women this way. We are going to distance ourselves from Trump, and we're not going to rally with him, maybe not even vote for him. I mean, this comes after months of Donald Trump saying horrific things about immigrants and refugees, and you cover this very closely. So what are your thoughts after seeing people turn on Donald Trump because of this specific video?
Well, it certainly concerns me as both a journalist and a woman, because it's difficult and it's really altered the calculus of how objective reporting could be when you have a candidate so openly derisive of opinions that don't comport with his lived fantasies. But, you know, it's even more difficult as a woman to stomach what he says because it's personally offensive. But back to the media standpoint, you know, Trump did sit down with a Latino media group recently, but they didn't talk about immigration. So this shows you how much hold Trump has on the media, right? Because he has gone after immigrants this entire campaign. He's been very anti-immigrant, very anti-refugee, anti-Muslim. And yet, when it comes to the questions that matter, we're all afraid to ask him because we're afraid of the lawsuits that occur. So he's also made aggressive behavior publicly acceptable, and this is something that I'm sure all of us have received hate mail for. And his rhetoric just makes people mean.
Well,
yes.
And also, Esther, you wrote about how during the second debate, he insulted a young Muslim woman who asked about Islamophobia. He told her that Muslims in the U.S. should spy on each other because they're potential terrorists. And a lot of people on social media made fun of this. They cracked jokes. But these comments have serious consequences. How do you think the media are reporting on that?
So, just to clarify, so people did report, you know, it's under the hashtag Muslims report things, so everybody should check that out. But it is pretty absurd that, for one thing, that he would tell Muslims to report on each other when that already does happen within the community, actually. There have been reports out that say that Muslims, up to 40% of tips come from the community. So they do see something, they do say something. So it's particularly offensive to say that they should continue to spy on each other. But it's also offensive because it just increases the acceptability and the rise in hate mail and hate attacks against Muslims and immigrants.
Jody, did you want to jump in there?
Well, I just wanted to say something that has really bothered me in the context of all of this, which is that in fact, Donald Trump has been attacking women all along. It's just that he's been attacking women of color and immigrant women. And it was when he started talking about white married women that suddenly the GOP got its knickers in a twist. I mean, if you think about it, when you are attacking immigrants, when you are attacking Muslim persons, when you are attacking, you know, people of color, you are attacking their mothers, daughters, sisters, their wives. Why is it now that, you know, that women should be quote unquote revered and upheld? It's because they're white women. Mm. And I just find, like, again, the lack of nuance in all of this, of the broader media landscape. And I totally agree that Donald Trump has, you know, has bullied the media. I mean, if you look at what's happening with the Apprentice tapes that haven't been released, we know that MGM, NBC, and Mark Burnett are holding these tapes under lock and key, and they claim they can't give them out because Trump has final approval. Well, entertainment lawyers told the New York Times that, yeah, his contractual obligations don't really extend to this kind of thing, so they could release them. But they are afraid that because Trump has so much ties financially to The Apprentice still, even though he's not on it, that they don't want to cut those ties with Trump. So for financial reasons, they're holding back tapes that are in the public interest. Meanwhile, they've hired Arnold Schwarzenegger, who is also a known abuser, to be the new host of The Apprentice. It's just, it's really obscene. Mm.
Sarah, do you want to jump in? What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, I think that all these people have been giving a free pass. You know, the only thing I would disagree with, you know, I think it's true that when Trump attacks, you know, non-white and non-Christian Americans, people, you know, especially in the media, shrugged in response. They let that go. They let extremist rhetoric become mainstreamed and normalized to the point that I think it stopped shocking people. But Trump did go after white women as well. You know, like Megyn Kelly is an example of that. And so that was there. You know, the accusations of sexual assault from white women were also, you know, mentioned sporadically in the news. They just weren't taken seriously. And so I think with the, you know, the revelation, quote unquote, of the Access Hollywood team was just that it was Trump speaking in his own words. And I think it's depressing that it took that tape for, you know, these claims to be taken seriously and for people to be believed and for other women to feel comfortable enough to come forward, because I think it's part of that media environment of knowing that if you come forward, you will be bullied by Trump and you will be possibly dismissed and mocked in the media as well, that, you know, of course it's going to make people reluctant to speak out.
And we were talking about how these comments have serious consequences. And Esther, Fox News went after the Chinese community by mocking them. It happened last week during Fox News's The O'Reilly Factor. And during this segment, Waters World, Fox reporter, if you can call him a reporter, Jesse Waters, went to New York's Chinatown to ask people who they are planning to vote for. And the entire segment, I mean, I watched it last night, and it's just, it's stomach churning. I mean, it
disgusting.
Was about humiliating and stereotyping the Asian American community. And you wrote about this, and Asian organizations, Asian journalist organizations have spoken out about this. Can you talk a little bit about media coverage of this? Because I hadn't heard about it until I saw your story.
So this was an issue where Jesse Waters went to Chinatown, like you said, and he talked to Asian people ostensibly to ask them about their political views, but instead he was making fun of our culture. And when I watched the segment, I had to stop twice because I grew increasingly angry at what I was seeing, because I was like, this is 2016. Mm-hmm. How am I, as a woman of minority woman, why am I being laughed at, you know, in this way and in these kinds of stereotypes? And what is he doing? And I can't believe the producer would let this kind of segment go on. So this kind of goes back to the whole othering of Asian Americans, how it's acceptable to still make fun of Asians in places like Hollywood still. You know, we saw Chris Rock last year make fun of these little Asian kids on stage. And for some reason, it's still okay to make fun of immigrants. It's still okay to make fun of Muslims. It's still okay to make fun of Asians, you know. So it's this behavior of making us into the others, making us into foreigners, that really is driving a wedge between Americans who have been here for a really long time. You know, Chinese Americans have been in this country for a very long time. They've worked on the railroad system out west. So we deserve better than this.
And you reported that a slew of Asian journalists, advocacy groups, and lawmakers have spoken out against this segment since it aired. Have you received or have you heard about other groups coming forward and saying this is unacceptable?
I know that some other advocacy groups from who are of people of color, they have come out in solidarity with us. So I do appreciate that. But why was the segment produced in the first place? And what I really hate about that segment was that Bill O'Reilly, at the end of that segment, very, very, was in support of it. He was like, oh, by the way, we're probably going to get some letters about this. Mm. So he knew already that this was going to be a very provocative sort of piece, and yet he still let it go through. And of course, you know, just based on that, we had to stand up for ourselves, because for so long we've been silent, and we've been silenced.
Right.
So I'm very happy that we have people in solidarity with us.
And Esther, before we go to break, I know that you regularly receive hate mail. Has the amount of hate mail increased since Donald Trump came on the scene?
So I've always received a lot of hate mail because I write on a very controversial topic. I write about immigration mostly. And so the amount of hate mail has increased since I started writing about Trump. But It's interesting because the kind of hate mail that I've received has evolved into personal attacks about my skin color and about my background. So people will call me a yellow journalist, not with any association to the Spanish-American War or anything, but based on the color of my skin. Mm.
That is Esther Lee. She's a reporter at Think Progress, where she covers immigration and refugees. Think Progress is a progressive news outlet, and you can see her piece, O'Reilly's Producer is Sorry You Didn't Get His Racist Jokes, but she does really important reporting on immigration and the refugee crisis. We're also joined by Sarah Kendzior, an op-ed columnist for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. We're also joined by Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW, local public radio. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion, or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, a toll-free number. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio or post to yourcallradio.org, or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org, or tweet us at yourcallradio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll speak with University of Hawaii Geography Professor Reese Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Speaking of the refugee crisis, over the past decade, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. He argues these deaths are not exceptional. They're the result of state attempts to contain the population and control access to resources. I hope you can join us for that on Monday. Next week, we're also putting shows together about legalizing marijuana. It might be legal in California in just a couple of months. We'll take a look at some other states, including Colorado and Washington, where it's already legal. We will also be doing shows about the Superfest Disability Film Festival. So I hope you can join us for those shows next week. And if you have an idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to weigh in on coverage of this presidential election and the video that surfaced recently of Donald Trump bragging about assaulting women, the women who are coming forward saying that Donald Trump publicly groped them and forcibly kissed them over the decades. What do you make of all of this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or tweet at Your Call Radio. I really did not think we'd be talking about this in 2016. Sarah, you have a really good column. You're a columnist for the Canadian paper, The Globe and Mail. You watched the recent debates with students on the campus of Washington University. Tell us about that experience, what it was like, and how it made you feel.
I mean, it was a terrible experience. I'm a WashU alum, you know, so I was there in 2008 when they hosted the vice presidential debate between Palin and Biden. And at that time, you know, people at WashU were kind of like, wow, you know, well, revved up for Barack Obama, or at least the majority of the students were. There's this, you know, the sense of hope and change that, you know, turned into the sense of grope and change with this election. And, you know, it's just such a, you know, overriding air of cynicism and frustration. And then, you know, that turned to horror once the debate actually began. You know, it was just so dirty and so ugly and so personal and vicious that I think students were stunned. You know, I've been covering Trump for a year, and, you know, even I was stunned by, you know, how low the discourse had denigrated, you know, had sunk to, and how women and others were denigrated throughout the debate. I was most appalled, honestly, you know, and this was brought up before, about how he responded to the Muslim woman who had asked the question about Islamophobia, in which he basically confirmed that, you know, her concerns were valid because he himself is Islamophobic. And the total lack of empathy, you know, shown toward that woman, I thought was just one of the most horrific things I've ever seen in any presidential debate.
You know, I've been thinking about this. What are conversations on colleges sounding like right now? What are people talking about in classrooms? Can you tell us a little bit more about what students were saying and how this is affecting them?
I mean, the students who I spoke to, you know, it was different than, you know, when I was there like almost a decade ago. You know, obviously many people were appalled by Trump. You know, the majority of students I talked to were not, in fact, voting for Trump, which I don't think was clear, you know, in the publicly aired debate where it sort of sounded like, you know, they or, you know, others were cheering him on. Many were, you know, against both Hillary and Trump. They were just fed up with the entire process. And, you know, to an extent, I can't blame them because they spent 8 years in a post-recession economy, you know, which I don't think was caused by Obama, but by Bush's policies and by Bush's wars and, you know, a lot of, you know, GOP dysfunction in Congress. And so they're very disillusioned. You know, they're often very cynical. And I felt sorry for them that this is their introduction to presidential politics, that this is the election they have to endure and that this is the one they cast their vote in. I mean, it's just not, it sets a terrible standard for what's normal. And, you know, I did a panel right before the debate where students could ask me questions. And one of the questions, you know, a young woman asked in complete earnestness was, how do you tell what a fact is? You know, I read the news, I read social media, and I cannot discern truth from reality anymore. And even mainstream, you know, allegedly credible outlets are parroting the same kind of rhetoric you see in conspiracy sites. So how do you tell what's real? And so, you know, me and the other panelists were encouraging them to just be critical, to look for primary sources, to analyze things in context. But I just keep thinking, like, you know, for young people, how are they going to navigate this sort of rhetoric, and how is this going to affect what they perceive as normal and truthful in future elections?
It's so true, and the same applies to young people who want to get into journalism. I've also been thinking a lot about that. Jody, what would you add?
I think this is a really critical issue that you're raising about people not knowing, you know, where to go for information. Obviously, we've had a real erosion in any kind of sense that there are people who are speaking from fact and evidence who don't have an ideological agenda. You know, we don't trust scientists anymore because the right has told us scientists don't know anything or have an ideological agenda. We don't trust public health institutions because the right has told us that, you know, there's other science out there that might differ. And I just think that this is one of the core urgencies that we face, is how and whether we can come back to a place where we can get people to be able to trust in the fact that there are conversations based on fact and evidence that need to be had, that those conversations can be debated, that the facts and the evidence can be debated within a certain sphere, but not always completely ignored. And this is one of the areas in which I despair the most, because I feel like it's such a huge problem, and it's so rooted in a lot of what we're seeing now, where people don't trust institutions at all. And of course, there has again have been a decade-long effort to discredit institutions, science, medicine, etc. You only have to look at abortion care to look at that, or reproductive health care, to see how that discrediting has worked. And I just think it's a really profound problem.
Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, a nonprofit online publication covering reproductive and sexual health, rights, and justice. Sarah Kenzior is an op-ed columnist for the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. She writes about politics, race, and economic inequality. Esther Lee is a reporter with Think Progress. She covers immigration and refugees. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Of course, I share your deep dismay and disgust. What I find so perplexing about the situation is we've seen this in Donald Trump for years, in Apprentice and Celebrity Apprentice. I mean, he was always a disgusting caricature of a white male demagogue. And he's been allowed to get this far because of the groundswell of support that we keep ignoring. We keep focusing on the individual and not really, we don't want to really think about the enormous numbers of people in the whole Republican Party who supported him to the point that he got. And we don't want to, just like we don't want to, you know, John Stump is retiring from Wells Fargo. We don't look at all the other executives, or they're, you know, they're somehow, they get off scot-free, and we just pillory this one person. What is Donald Trump representing that we're ignoring about the reality that is America outside of the Bay Area?
Yeah, well, good question. Jody, you write about this. What are your thoughts? Jody? Did we lose Jody? All right, Sarah, do you want to take that?
I'll take that, especially because I'm very far outside the Bay Area. I'm, you know, here in Missouri, and I'm surrounded by Trump supporters, and I've, you know, gone at pretending to be a Trump fan to a lot of their rallies. You know, one thing I would say is that there's not a monolith. There's a real variety of people who are supporting Trump for different reasons. You know, some of this actually is frustration with their economic situation. Some of it is a kind of white patriot militancy, and some of it is, you know, flat out racism, you know, reminiscent of the KKK. I think that, you know, while those differences are there, the end result is what's important, because even if your primary reason for supporting Trump is not based in racism, you know, you are willing to tolerate that. You're willing to tolerate his abusiveness to women. You're willing to tolerate his corruption, and you're willing to tolerate his ignorance. And so, you know, that concerns me most of all, that there's this sort of self-centered, you know, well, what's in it for me, at the expense of, you know, who's going to be most hurt by, you know, should Trump win, you know, which at this point I don't think will happen, but I think people will be hurt nonetheless. And, you know, that concerns me, because it will not be these white male voters who are the bulk of his base that will be affected. It's going to be, you know, non-white and female citizens who are affected the most.
Esther, would you like to add anything?
I think that if we were only informed by what we're seeing in the headlines, we actually wouldn't see any real policy plans. So for Trump, what I think is going to be really interesting is when everybody goes home for Thanksgiving. So I'm currently in Washington, D.C., so I'm within the Beltway and the Beltway bubble. So I don't see what Sarah sees, right? But once I go home for Thanksgiving, I am going to see what Sarah sees because I do have a lot of Republican and Democratic relatives. And I think that to the extent that people are supporting Trump, you know, that's something I'm really going to have to push back on because it's something that should be offensive, and it has been offensive this entire campaign. So I would really like to see what my relatives have to say.
Do you have any relatives supporting Trump?
Oh, yeah, I have plenty. I have. So my boyfriend's relatives all support Trump, and that's something that I would really like to hear from, because as an immigrant, that's personally insulting, and that's like advocating for the deportation of myself and, you know, millions of other people.
And do you know the reasons why they're supporting him?
They like him because he is not afraid to say what they're thinking.
Right.
That's what they say.
Right. You hear that a lot.
Yes. And unfortunately, you know, like when I, as a woman of color, go to places like Ohio, which is where my boyfriend, his family is based, you know, I get that a lot. And I see the blatant racism. And I'm not in that every day because I live in D.C. But for the people who live there, this is their lived experience.
Well, thank you for calling in. We have an email from Kathy who says, one fallout of this news is that women like me will have old, long-buried events emerge once again and haunt them. Many, I'm sure, like me, were blamed for inappropriate behavior by men, even when the behavior was from a religious leader much older, who should have been wiser and respectful. One of the things that's been interesting about all of this is women coming forward to tell their own stories. The PBS NewsHour had a piece about author Kelly Oxford, who shared her own sexual assault experience, and she had hashtag It's Not Okay. More than 30 million people have also either shared their experiences or visited her Twitter page. And, you know, so people are coming out really talking about their own experiences. Jody, are you back with us?
I am.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit about that, Jody, how women are taking what's happening right now to speak out about what they have to face on a daily basis?
Yeah, well, there's been a tremendous amount of people speaking out. You know, I think in a way, what I've seen at least, and even for me, and I don't consider myself easily triggered, even for me, this has been a really triggering time. I just feel like this sense of, like, you know, like trauma from all of this, and I think what the shining sort of, you know, undercover of all of this, or the whatever you say, the silver lining, is that I've heard so many people grappling with sexual assault, sexual harassment, and abuse, and talking about it out loud. I heard yesterday, for example, a radio program where they talked with students who were talking about using this tape that Donald Trump and Billy, what's his name, Bush, to really talk about how endemic in our society sexual harassment, sexual abuse, assault are, and really grappling with it in smart ways. I've seen, you know, athletes come out to talk about, you know, the whole bullshit rant about locker room talk. I think that women who have been and most of us have experienced some form of harassment, if not outright abuse, you know, are not only feeling trauma, but also starting to feel a sense of space to talk about this and have more support and courage around talking about it. I think that's why you see women now coming out about Trump, because even many of these women who stayed silent for many years are saying in their own words, I now feel like I can no longer stay silent because this man is a predator. And I think that seeing someone who supposedly holds this, you know, high place in our society because we value money over so much else, is that that he's not immune to being called out for this, and that we all are sticking together in that. And I just think, in a way, it's both traumatizing, but in the long run may actually create more space for healthy conversation about these things. At least that's my hope, because I'm seeing glimmers of that.
Well, let's hope. Well, let's go to another caller, Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Yes. My question is, doesn't this call into question our entire process of choosing candidates for these offices, that it took until a month before the election, and this campaign has been going on for years, to have all these stories come out? That's my question.
All right. Sarah, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a difference between, you know, the process of the election and these particular stories, you know, because as we've all kind of noted, these stories tend to come out in an avalanche once women feel that, you know, it's safe for them to say it, that they know they'll have public support, that they're more likely to be believed. And I think they also feel an obligation when they see another woman who's not believed, you know, who's been assaulted by the same man, you know, to step out and say, well, this happened to me too, and she's telling the truth. And so I think that, you know, that is how these stories are coming through. In terms of the process of the election, though, you know, it obviously, there are many, many flaws in this, you know, in terms of how the media enabled Trump to get to this point and was complicit in his rise, to what the state of the GOP candidates looked like, to how easy the GOP, how easily they were manipulated, how reluctant they were to condemn Trump's statements, and, you know, also some, you know, lack of sharp critique from, you know, Democrats and independents as well, especially when it came to groups that they were not in. You know, I think if we didn't have a white male-dominated media, we might have seen things, you know, discussed in a different way. You know, you watch a panel and it's you know, with a group of pundits, and there's usually one token woman, one minority, you know, something along those lines. And I don't think that the discourse would have gone on as it had and the issues been framed in the way they were if there is, you know, more equity in terms of who was able to discuss these things in a public forum and what information people were able to hear.
Hmm. All right. Well, thank you for calling in. Jody, I wanted to ask you about Mike Pence and abortion, because you all have been covering this extensively. In a speech at Liberty University on Wednesday, Mike Pence said a Trump-Pence ticket will defund Planned Parenthood. He said he longs to see the day that Roe v. Wade is consigned to the ash heap of history where it belongs. Mike Pence signed one of the most anti-abortion laws last year as Indiana governor. The National Network of Abortion Funds called it one of the most vicious anti-abortion bills the United States has ever seen. It includes 31 draconian provisions, including a requirement to bury or cremate aborted fetuses. A judge blocked this law. Even his own colleagues said it went too far. So, Jody, across the board, Mike Pence is described as a soft-spoken Christian. In fact, even after the vice presidential debate, a number of commentators on NPR said he did a good job. He's going to make the Republican Party feel good about this ticket again.
Yeah, well, we have a piece that's going to be published this weekend that, you know, effectively says, define decent, why Mike Pence is not a decent man. Because you can't be a, quote, decent man if you're willing to deny people access to health care, if you're willing to let HIV rage in your state because you think that, you know, needle exchange and condoms are immoral. Here's the thing. Donald Trump may have said he wants to grab women by the pussy, but Mike Pence is leading a legal and regulatory effort to completely control women's sexual organs and their bodies. And, you know, it's not hyperbole. This is what these people are doing. They are trying to completely control and regulate women's bodies. So in a different way, it's a different form of sexual abuse of women. It's not the, you know, the regular way we talk about sexual abuse, but when you take basic health care and deny it to people based on your own religious, quote-unquote, belief about what those people should be like and how they should act, then you are abusing an entire population of women. So Mike Pence is as abusive in his, quote, soft-spoken Christian way as Donald Trump is. He's just looking at an entire population of women to control. I really don't see the difference between them and the media trying to paint him as this, you know, quote-unquote, decent man is doing a disservice to all women and LGBT
persons in this country.
And low-income people. Mother Jones had a piece about how between 2006 and 2009, Mike Pence voted against raising the minimum wage, voted against expanding health coverage for lower-income children, providing additional funding for Section 8 vouchers, which would help low-income families pay rent. He voted against all of this. He slashed Planned Parenthood funding, spurring clinic closures and an HIV outbreak. You just mentioned this, Jody. Why isn't this getting more attention?
Because it's become the, you know, somehow if you have the label conservative or the label liberal, you've done your job of explaining people. And you don't have to delve further than that to see what that really means. So we, you know, describe and take for granted that Mike Pence, being who Mike Pence is a, quote, conservative Christian, quote, Republican conservative, who has his way of employing conservative values, and who, among all of the other things that you've also, you know, stated, Rose, also took money from infant mortality reduction programs to fund other programs that have nothing to do with it and to funnel it into religious organizations. He's taken money from other kinds of health programs and funneled them into crisis pregnancy centers. And he runs around boasting about his economic prowess in the state when, in fact, Indiana has done really poorly under Mike Pence. So it's just, it's another failure of the media to look beyond the labels that have been created for the ease of reporting and to really dig into what does this person actually mean when he talks about these policies. Every time I hear Mike Pence say and get away with what a great governor he was for Indiana, I cringe when somebody doesn't call him on that.
Well, and hardly any of this came out during the VP debate. Esther, quickly, what are your thoughts?
So I think that this is absolutely having a spillover effect on restrictive abortion legislation, because if you look at a state like Texas, they just passed a new law at the beginning of 2016 that required abortion clinics to ask patients for IDs, which is something that not many undocumented immigrants in particular have. And, you know, this is a group of people who do contribute to the U.S. economy as well. So they do deserve the right to also have safe and legal options for abortions. So what you're saying is a lot more women turning to more dangerous avenues to get to abortion.
Not only that, but let's say young women who just aren't comfortable, maybe they don't want family to know about this. I mean, there's just so many other elements to bring into that. What are your thoughts, Sarah? We've got about a minute left. I mean, I think connecting these dots is one of the most important aspects of this story right now, and they're really not being connected. Definitely not on the cable shows that I've heard or seen, or really in the national media.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, especially with Pence. You know, I think that there's a focus on vulgarity of language and mannerisms over the actual substance of, you know, what these two men think about issues, which is, you know, very similar. You know, I went to a Mike Pence rally in St. Louis. You know, he said things that were extremely inflammatory, extremely misogynist, and he said them in a folksy, relaxed, calm way that resonated extremely well with an elderly, primarily white Midwestern crowd. And so I think he has, you know, a very effective demeanor in terms of convincing people he's more harmless than he is.
Sarah Kendzior is an op-ed columnist with the Canadian paper The Globe and Mail. Jody Jacobson is editor-in-chief of Rewire, and Esther Lee is a reporter with Think Progress. Sarah, Jody, and Esther, thank you for joining us, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you so much, Rose.
Thank you. And we just got an email from Mike who said, you can watch the documentary The Central Park Five on Amazon Prime for free and on Hoopla. Thank you for that, Mike. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with University of Hawaii geography professor Rhys Jones about his new book, Violent Borders, Refugees and the Right to Move. Over the past decade, 40,000 people died trying to cross international borders. Rhys argues these deaths are not exceptional. They're the result of state attempts to contain the population and control access to resources. Email your questions about this crisis to feedback@yourcallradio.org and join us live at 10 a.m. with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.